Today, absolutely nobody's got a clue. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and private news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon, and Tarek Brooker's back with me. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
I'm pretty good. And, we sort of every time we come on a Friday, we think, oh, it's getting more crazy. But, hey, it's getting more crazy. And anybody who thinks we know what the answer is, check out now, folks.
Well, that's the thing. Nobody knows what the answer is. I mean, you know, we're even starting to see that type of commentary come in from the ECB, come in from the Fed. And they're just like, what's going on? They're just like, We don't know. We're doing the best we can with what we've got. And that's part of the reason why rates, you know, keep going up, because they're not certain about the path of inflation.
Well, being data-driven, of course, is a bit of a problem when the data doesn't show you what you want to see.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the problem at this point, especially because, you know, you've got all this backward-looking data that says, well, inflation's looking pretty bad. And, well, even a lot of the forward-looking data doesn't look too crash hot, but I'm sure, you know, we'll get to that later in the show.
I think we will. And it is interesting because I'm sure we'll also touch on another important factor because, of course, a lot of mortgage holders in Australia are now really feeling the pain. But never fear, 40-year mortgages are on the card. So that'll solve it, won't it?
Oh, geez. It's something, isn't it? It's really something. They've just... But the thing is, A 40-year mortgage shouldn't really be viable in theory, you know, considering, you know, I mean, say, for example, your own work on the median age of a first home buyer is pushing closer to 40 than it is to 30. If you're giving someone who's, you know, 36, 37, 38, a 40-year mortgage, you're not just talking about working until retirement, you're talking about working until they're very nearly dead, you know, based on current, you know, sort of life expectancies. So, although, I mean, maybe that's the plan. Who knows?
Well, you know what the definition of a mortgage is? It's until death.
Yeah, life debt.
Yeah, and of course, the other point is that the idea is that you can offer an interest-only period up front, right? So that basically means that you are managing to find your mortgage repayments looking rather similar to where they were back then on principal interest, but interest-only. But the problem is, of course, the amount of interest that you stack up over 40 years, well, the banks will, you know, take it to the bank, literally.
Yeah, the thing that I find, you know, a bit ridiculous is a whole lot of people have asked me on Twitter, why doesn't Australia have 30-year mortgages? Why don't we have 30-year fixed mortgages? And the answer is bank profitability. It's all about bank profitability. You know, in decades gone by, sure, it was because we had an underdeveloped long-end bond market. But considering the demand for long rated, you know, for long AAA, you know, AAA or AA rated credit, in today's world, yeah, we could do 30-year mortgages. We could have done them easily during the financial crisis. Sorry, during COVID, but we didn't, because 30-year mortgages are written on razor thin margins relative, well, generally written on razor thin margins during challenging times, compared with Australian mortgages, which are written on some of the largest margins on the face of the earth.
That's exactly right. In fact, the current mortgage system is designed to enhance the profitability of the banks, even through the cycle. And, of course, it's interesting that ANZ, when they came out the other day, said, we're now looking down at postcode level for signs of stress. Well, there you go. That'll solve the problem then, won't it?
Well, you know what that means. That means you're going to get an email later today saying, hey, Martin, can we have a look at your data?
Yeah, I have got more interest in my data than I've ever had before. I'll say no more than that, but it is an interesting conversation. Anyhow, we better get on with the slides because you've put all the hard work in terms of actually telling a story. So let's rock and roll, shall we?
Yes, yeah, indeed. Let's do that. As usual, the charts, if you want to have a closer look, are available at avidcom.substack.com. Big thank you to everyone who's donated, everyone who's subscribed. It's all very much appreciated and just, you know, helps me, you know, grow this thing out. And just a quick word before we get into it. Today's chart show is brought to you by me. and I will be doing a live in-person thing for Pepperstone Talks in Melbourne in next month, which if you want to have a look at that, I'll get Martin to include a link in the description. So without further ado, let's get into it. there's been this narrative that Aussie inflation isn't so bad. It's not so bad. Everything's fine. Blah, 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 blah. You know, we're doing great. We're not doing great for a start. But I think this chart from NAB tells the story quite well, that basically when you look at inflation on the trimmed mean metric, that Australia's really not that far behind the US. And it's just, it's really not looking all that promising in relative terms either. And I'd also add that there are key differences between the Australian CPI and the US CPI, which make direct comparisons a bit distorted, shall we say. So, for example, in the US, used cars are included in the CPI. In Australia, they're not. Yet the largest contribution to US core CPI from used cars was over 2%, whereas here in Australia, that hasn't fed through at all. So I think that's going to be an interesting little divergence that's going to play out in the coming year, maybe 18 months, because US inflation has that headwind. Aussie inflation doesn't.
And the other point is that the element of housing is a bigger element in the US relative to Australia as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you look at the shelter component in the US, it's over 30% of the CPI, which is owner's equivalent rent and actual rents themselves. But if you look at the shelter component for Australia based on market rents, you know, based on actual market prices or even perceptions of market prices, it's only a little over 7%. So yeah, it's not really super comparable in that regard.
No.
And I mean, that's going to be really interesting because we've got all these increases in rents to feed through. And did you see Louis Christopher's tweet about the ABS data that the entire nation's rental price data was done up until very recently only on 4,000 households?
Exactly. Yes. A wonderful subpar sample. No wonder it was all over the place. And of course, you've still got this issue that those higher new rents will flow into that data over time. And, you know, the ABS now has changed their methodology a little bit. But, so the conclusion is that probably relative to the US, the inflation in Australia is probably understated on a trimmed mean basis. So, you know, we're flying in precisely the same direction as the US. I suppose one difference is that wages momentum is probably lower here than over there at the moment.
I would definitely say that was the case. But one thing I thought was interesting was HIA came out with a report today saying that tradie wages had risen, I believe it was 10.4%. Now, I've got a call out to HIA to clarify a few things on that. But if you just take that purely at face value, right, as hourly wages in the construction sector rising by a little over 10%, which, you know, if anyone's hired a tradie recently, doesn't seem all that inconceivable. That by itself is going to drive the wage price index to around about 0.9% on its own. And there's still the other 91% of workers. Yeah. So I wonder, are wages perhaps performing a little bit better than the RBA and the ABS thinks? And, you know, that sort of justification for the step down in rising rates, is that actually justified in reality? And that's a point that I believe ANZ has made recently.
Yeah, they have. And indeed, of course, it's a bit historical anyway, because of the time the data gets through. And the distribution across different industries is actually where it gets quite interesting. But I also would say that in my surveys, looking specifically at those working in the construction sector, they've done really, really well over the last year or so. Well, because nobody can get a tradie, basically.
No, exactly. It's all about just supply and demand. Exactly. Well, I think we'll get to the next slide. Okay. Now, this is a nice little breakdown of inflation between goods and services and just the regular CPI. Now, up until relatively recently, services inflation has been really, really quite low. It's only been about a little over 1% year on year. But we're now seeing that move up from 1% to 1.7% in a single quarter. Now, this is tracking broadly similarly in some ways to the way things played out in the US. At first, it was goods inflation, it was supply chain issues, it was all those different things. But then over time, it spread into the services sector, became more broad-based and more entrenched. Now, what I suspect is happening is that's slowly occurring within the Aussie economy. And that's even something that, the banks themselves, in particular, I believe it was Westpac's Bill Evans, made that particular point. It was either yesterday or the day before.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very significant issue. And as you say, we are aping the US. The other interesting observation there is the non-discretionary inflation is now above 8%. Right. So the things you have to buy is much, much higher. The discretionary stuff's a lot lower. So the things you have to buy, the inflation rate's even higher too as well. And that's, by the way, similar to what happened in the US.
Yeah, and I think it's also worth noting that a significant proportion of the the non-discretionary items, you know, the things that you need, food, shelter, etc., is rents. And rents are still showing a 2.6% year-on-year or 2.8% year-on-year growth, which is nowhere near the sort of 12, 15, 20% that some of the other private providers are seeing. So there's still, as you say, all that lagged rental inflation to go through. And well, it's just a painfully bad picture, really.
Yeah, I think it is, unfortunately. And the monthly numbers haven't changed the story. It just sort of reinforces the story, frankly.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that if the monthly numbers ever show anything positive, they're going to go from they're just preliminary. They're just preliminary. Don't put too much stock into them. To look at these numbers, they are God.
Exactly.
All righty. Now, in this, I have assumed rather optimistically, shall we say, that wages growth will rise from 2.6% to 3% in the third quarter. Now, I'm pretty sure no one thinks that, but let's just say for argument's sake that it does happen to give this chart the best possible chance of not looking absolutely disastrous. But it still looks absolutely disastrous. You know, you're seeing years and years of real wages growth evaporate with each passing quarter, unfortunately.
And let me just make the point to Tarek that that's of course an average across all types of households, right? If you actually do a segmentation by different types of households, the most well-off versus the least well-off, guess what? The one in the least well-off group, they're actually even further behind because the inflation, has an eroding impact on everybody. But if your income growth has been more strong, particularly in some of the financial services industries, the tech industries, mining, where wages has been stronger, then you're not doing so bad. But that means that others are doing even worse.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, you see these articles in the AFR, you see them, you know, you see these reports, you see like, you know, lawyers, you know, like, as you say, you know, people hiring people in the tech sector, financial services, tradies, etc., all doing very, very well. But, you know, for wages growth to come in, you know, 2.6%, that means that a lot of other people are doing a whole lot worse. So yeah, it's not a pretty picture, unfortunately.
And of course, you didn't, but you should have included politicians are also doing very well, thank you. Plus, of course, those wonderful big retirement packages they get too.
Well, I guess the thing with politicians is that's not really news. You know, everyone else's wages, you know, even if you're, you know, you're in a high end profession, that will ebb and flow over time with supply and demand. But if you're a politician, you can just vote yourself a pay rise. And well, it's a rare politician that doesn't vote themselves a pay rise. Let's put it that way.
How good is Australia?
Well, I guess in fairness, it's not really an Australian issue, and you know, in and of itself, there's plenty of other people voting themselves pay rises. I mean, look at the UK. You know, things are disastrous. You know, pretty disastrous there for a lot of people, and it's like, you know, let's give ourselves a pay rise.
I know. Well, they're a special breed, aren't they? You know, a law unto themselves. You know, completely insulated from the ravages of inflation, and they just go on giving themselves pay rises. And what do you do?
Yeah, the government of the people rhetoric really is starting to rub me the wrong way more than it usually does. You know, I'm just sitting here and I'm just like looking through the budget. And I'm just like, yeah, well, they haven't mentioned a whole bunch of things in here. It's just like, oh, what about the rental crisis? What about all these homeless people living in tents?
Yep.
Oh yeah, no. But we've got this promise of this vague promise about building a million homes that would have got built anyway, but you know.
Well, that's somewhere down the track. In one of my shows, I called the budget a Swiss cheese budget, right? It looks superficially okay, but as soon as you started looking at it, you see these massive holes. And one of the really interesting ones is the assumed consumption rate next year. right? In other words, how much will consumers be spending next year? They've assumed that it's going to go up significantly from what happens this year.
Really?
Yes.
I haven't got to that particular page. And what sort of growth are they looking at?
So this year, the household consumption is 4.1, right?
Yep.
The assumption next year, it's going up to 6.5.
Is this real? Like
that's
when I say real.
That's the forecast, 22-23.
Yeah.
This is the real gross domestic product line.
Yeah.
Okay. And then in 23-24, it's down to 1.25.
So basically next year is going to be magical before everything reverts to normal.
Exactly.
That's what all budgets always say.
Big compliment down again. And I say, if you take the number back even to the 4%, which is where it is this year, right, you blow a huge hole in all the numbers. So it's clearly the plug number they've put in to make it all work.
I can't say I'm surprised, but I mean, it's really to be expected. It's par for the course at this point.
Yep. You just look for the hole. There's always a hole there somewhere. There's always a little sort of tweak somewhere that somebody's done. So I think I found it. So there you go.
Yeah.
Wherein I would argue that we should be looking at it significantly down. In fact, if you take it back down to the growth this year, then the budget falls over.
Well, I'm shocked. I mean, to be completely honest with you, if you look at some of the sort of, you know, before even getting into the nitty gritty, you know, nuts and bolts of the budget, if you look at the sort of relatively basic things, estimates like, you know, GDP, estimates on unemployment, all those sorts of, you know, rather basic things, Jesus, they're heroic. You know, the idea that unemployment, you know, you've got Chalmers talking about a global recession, you know, talking about, oh, you know, this major economic slowdown. They're talking, you know, this sizable ramp up in immigration. You know, if you look at, say, for example, temporary visa numbers for, you know, students, skilled visa holders, all these other different categories returning to normal, we've still got about another 300,000 plus people to come into the country over the next 12 months, not including any organic growth that will occur during that time, plus the record level of net permanent migration. So, you know, you put all that together, it doesn't really make for a, you know, an unemployment rate that's gonna stay with, you know, this sort of 4.25%. The job creation engine of the country just I don't think it's there for that to be maintained across the forward estimates out to 2026.
Yeah.
Oh well, it's gonna be interesting to watch anyways. It's, you know, like for me at this point, politics is more of a spectator sport than anything because I've just got to the point where I'm just over it. You know, you just listen to it. It's just garbage day in, day out. Like, I listen to it because I have to and because it's important, but I'm not happy about it.
No, well, I think that's exactly right. Well, some of the rubbish that's being spilled on both sides at the moment, I was listening to the reply speech last evening and sort of had to get out and walk around the room a couple of times because I got so frustrated with it. So they...
Yeah. I'm with you on that one, mate, 100%. Okay, now... Recently, the CEO of Alinta Energy came out and said that household energy costs were likely to rise by about 35% over the next 12 months. And he pretty much pointed out that was a relatively conservative estimate. Some of what we've heard from the government recently is that we're looking at about a 56% increase in household energy costs over the next 2 years, which I believe is basically just the tail end of 2022 and 2023. So what I've done here is I've basically input those numbers into the CPI, and then I've added in the rental inflation that's been seen over the last 12 months by Domain and by SQM Research. To sort of give a bit of an idea of the inflationary factors that are arguably already baked into the CPI, depending on how the rents feed in and how long all that takes. And basically, it just goes to show that if even with the Domain scenario, that two-thirds of the RBA's target is going to be consumed by these two factors alone. And this accounts for less than 10% of the CPI. So there's still the other 90% of the CPI that needs to not to all put together come up with one percentage point of inflation. So, you know, depending on how all these different things feed into the CPI, it's not looking pretty.
No, and of course, the fact is that we know that food prices will continue to be high because of the second-order impacts. So if you take electricity and gas prices and it percolates through into so many other things too, it's one of the reasons why a lot of costs in another, lot of other areas. And if you look at the manufacturing sector, of course, a lot of, they've got big input costs in terms of energy. So they're going to have to put their costs up as well. So the chances of squeezing everything else into that very small element and being within your 2 to 3% target is zero.
Well, unless, you know, we see a GFC type meltdown and everything just completely falls to bits again. But I mean, even then, I mean, I think that's a situation that down the road, depending on how things play out, is worth exploring. That, you know, that even if we do see these types of meltdowns, actually, it's worth exploring because I have a slide in a minute that does it for the US. So that will do quite nicely, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay, sounds very interesting. Yeah, and you know, the point about scenarios is we should explore them at the moment because there are so many variables in there and so many alternatives. I was reading the commentary overnight from the US because, of course, the US data was not where the people expected it in terms of GDP, right? And so everyone's saying, whoopee, well, actually, no, things are a lot better. And, of course, Biden came out and said, well, you know, it's looking pretty good just in terms of the election that's coming up shortly. But, of course, other people say, well, hang on a moment, that means the Fed may have to actually lift rates even higher because the momentum in the economy is stronger than we thought it was. It's like you can't win whichever way you look at it. You know, there are good news, bad news, you go up, you go down. I don't know.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I mean, if you really dig into the partials, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, it is pretty bad. Absolutely, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, the last three quarters of US data, pretty much all of 2022 has been distorted by inventories, by trade, by these factors, which, you know, caused a technical recession and now it's caused it to come out of a technical recession. So yeah, it's just a bit of a mess, really.
And it's just worth exploring one thing here, Tara. You know, there's the so-called base effect, right? So what happened previously, when it's reversed, can have a significant impact on where the numbers end up. And I've heard a number of people who are experts in the field claiming that, of course, all that past inflation, which has gone through, will drop out over the next few months. So automatically, inflation will come back down into target range, even if the Fed doesn't do anything else. Now, I'm highly sceptical of that particular argument because of the way that I think inflation has got itself embedded and entwined in everything we do. But it's still fascinating that a lot of people are saying it's all base effects, you know, it'll all shake out. And the other point, of course, is that the one that from the US overnight was the first, you know, indicative indicator, right? It's going to be another few weeks before they actually sort of come around with the second calculation. And, of course, they managed to give you a quarterly grossed annual view, which is wacky in its own way anyway.
I know. They're the only people who do it. They just, you know, it's like, oh, our growth was 2.6% this quarter. And you go, wow, that's pretty good. And then they go annualized and you just go, oh, okay. All right. You know, if that's the way you guys want to do it and you want to keep with the imperial system of measurement, then that's great. Good for you.
Absolutely. It's not very not very clear and straightforward, I'm afraid. But, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about it. So,
yeah, I've seen quite a few takes recently that just make no sense.
No.
Like even if you take, like, you know, the sort of word of the Fed or the Congressional Budget Office as gospel, and then you read some of these takes, they make absolutely no sense whatsoever. You know, like there was one the other day that said that if the US sheds 35,000 jobs a month over the next 2023, that inflation will be back at 2% by the end of next year. And that just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, if you look at the labor market is not going to have an impact on inflation at all if that number of jobs are lost. And it's like, that's literally what the Congressional Budget Office says. It's what PIMCO and Deutsche and even the Fed say, you know, like, 35,000 jobs a month in an economy the size of the US is basically it's not far off a rounding error.
Yep.
You know, like it's what, about 420,000 jobs. During our last chat, I posted up a chart that showed what would happen if the US lost 175,000 jobs a month. And we still wouldn't hit an unemployment rate that was actually contractionary on inflation at the lowest possible estimate for that particular figure until October next year. You know, it's just, it blows my mind. And my apologies to the viewers for the little rant, but man, they're just, a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense out there.
Another example to do with employment, right? You know, the employment numbers from Australia came out a bit weird.
Yeah.
But actually, most of that's to do with the change sample.
Thank you. Thank you. So many people, you know, so many commentators are just like, oh, the labor market in Australia is rolling over. No, it isn't. You look at the sampling over the last three reports. All of the samples have been wacky, and you've had a weak sample feed in and a good sample feed out. What I want to look at is the actual underlying impact of the labor market on the existing sample at the time, not just what this different sample has done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, almost none of the commentators that I saw even bothered to read the small print, right? I always try to read the small print at the bottom there when they explain the sampling. Because actually, the sampling percentage movements are really quite significant.
Yeah, some of them are huge. You know, you're talking about some sample. I believe one of the samples was like 4.2% unemployment feeding in, and one of the ones feeding out had an unemployment rate of 2.8. These are huge, huge, huge swings. I mean, really, if anything, the fact that the unemployment rate hasn't deteriorated significantly from these weak samples being rotated in is actually a sign of strength for the labor market, not weakness.
Yep, absolutely. But you see, people are trying to look for those forward signs that means the RBA will pivot, you know. Although I think people are quietly redefining pivot not to mean cutting interest rates, but just not quite lifting rates so fast, right? Isn't
I know.
that funny?
Oh, the pivot debate. It's just no. A pivot is when they cut rates. Okay, that's what a pivot was in 1974. What a pivot was in 2018. It's what a pivot will be till the end of time. Okay, it's just. But by the same token, I think it was Muhammad El-Erian who came out recently, who basically just said that they're just looking for anything to hang their hat on. Just
Exactly.
something to say this is less hawkish, and less hawkish is now dovish.
Yeah. I have to say I like his commentary. I do follow what he says quite closely because I think he makes some really, really good points and is sort of, you know, just pointing to some of the stupidities, you know, within the within the system here. It is pretty amazing. But and of course Westpac's now saying RBA 50 basis points on Melbourne Cup Day.
That's a big call from them, I will say. And
Yeah.
to be fair, Bill Evans has made some big calls in the past, and in the past, he's been right a reasonable percentage of the time. So, I mean, you know, maybe he's taken the temperature pretty well there. And although, I mean, even CBA has been forced to adjust their forecast higher. I mean, the lowest big four bank estimate for the peak cash rate is now 3.1%. And you know, I mean, I think we could still go a whole lot. I mean, realistically, it's just about if something breaks externally. If not, I think that the ANZ, NAB, Westpac scenario of sort of 3.6, 3.85 is pretty ballpark.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if they did do 50, although they'd have a bit of egg on their face because, of course, everyone was saying, oh, it shows that they were actually beginning to sort of ease back a little bit. And, oh, no, we're going to put the accelerator down again and lift the rates some more because the inflation is still, much higher than we thought and the employment's not actually that bad and et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be very interesting to see how they explain the next shenanigans.
It is going to be interesting because I mean I've heard from a few people, you know, just from anecdotes from real estate agents and a few other different types of, and a few other people in different industries, and some of them are just saying that like a lot, you know, quite a few people took the RBA raising by 0.25 as a sign that basically, you know, the rate hikes were very nearly over, and that, you know, that not in the not too distant future, you know, we could see rate cuts. And there's been quite a few commentators out there who haven't really helped, you know, with you know their rhetoric feeding into that as well, that you know that property is going to bottom and all this other
Absolutely right.
stuff.
Oh, the number of times I've seen articles saying, hey, it's about to turn again, you know, the rates are and rises are nearly over now, etc., etc. And of course, that then gets the real estate agents and the all of the other guys, on the front foot trying to encourage people to sort of buy now before you miss out. I don't think it's quite where they think it is.
Well, this is exactly why it's going to be so problematic, shall we say. You know, I mean, let's say, for example, the CBA scenario is correct, and we see another 25 basis point hike on Cup Day, and we see another one in December. We're still pushing up towards a borrowing power reduction of around about 25% anyway. So even if, you know, shall we say that we'll call the CBA scenario the bullish scenario, and we'll call the ANZ and Westpac one the bearish scenario, or the bearish end, the market one's the really bearish one, you're still talking about a 25, 30% reduction in household borrowing power. So it's a fairly significant sort of blow in that regard. And that's still, all of this is still yet to feed in. And that's something that even Governor Lowe and some of the other folks at the RBA have continually hammered home. This hasn't fed in yet. This hasn't fed in yet.
Yeah, well, it's 2 to 3 months to be able to flow in. And interestingly, I had a couple of chats with people this week whose borrowing power is now down 30% from where they were before the first rate rise.
Wow.
30%, right? And they're not particularly disadvantaged. You know, they've got a reasonable amount of equity saved and a reasonable income coming in, but they wanted to sort of max up quite firmly, and now they're 30% down. Interesting. And interestingly as well, Tariq, that the valuation that's being used for the mortgage appraisal process is also significantly down too. So you've actually got this sort of dual pressure. Not only can you borrow less, but now the valuations at which effectively the banks are prepared to transact have come down too. So that means that property is now less affordable rather than more affordable, you know, net of all those things.
Yeah. And I think that's going to be something interesting to watch over the next year, 18 months, as this particular force feeds into the market.
Yep.
Because at the moment, the market in a lot of different places, I would say probably most notably in Sydney, is being distorted by low listing volumes, by the low level of listing volumes and the low level, and in particular, the low level of growth in new listing volumes. I mean, like CoreLogic had some data out, I believe it was not last month, which showed that the number of properties for sale in Australia as a whole was about 30% below where it was in 2018. So we've still got that sort of weak volume market thing going on. But I think, which raises an interesting point, when are we going to start to see sales from people who've either just held off during the pandemic, or they've held off to try and get a better price, and now they need to move just because of, you know, the fact that you need a bigger house, you need a smaller house just for life reasons. Or then there's also the people who are just going to be looking at their finances and go, I can't afford this. I need to transact. So working out where those particular pain points sit, it, I think, could be key to how the property market's going to play out.
Well, I think you're right. And, my quick read is watch the first quarter of next year. So there are quite a few people sort of, you know, going to see up till Christmas and beyond. A lot of the property that's currently listed is actually second or third tier category quality property. So old investment properties that are no longer, working their way through. Interestingly, a lot of Airbnb is starting to come on now. And that's because a lot of the Airbnb was being run by people who really didn't know what they were doing. And so their vacancy rates have been actually still quite high. And a lot of people now don't have the money to be able to go and, you know, grab Airbnb weekends and those sorts of things. And so that's there. And the other one that's fascinating is the first-time buyers were sort of, you know, thinking, well, maybe there's a little wind of opportunity because prices have come back a little bit. And by the way, Brisbane and the area around Brisbane is where we're seeing the most significant falls at the moment. Less so in some areas of Sydney, although if you go out west, then there are 20% plus falls. And there are still areas where they're still worse than they were in 2017-18, if you know where to look. The listings in Melbourne are much higher than Sydney, interestingly, as well, and going up. So you've got to look granularly. But the falls in and around Brisbane are pretty scary, actually, at the moment. And I was talking to somebody up there who's in the know, and he was saying that he's not seen anything quite like it because they had the massive run, of course, and now it's come down again. So I think there's a lot to play out here yet. I don't think we're at the end of the story, as it were.
No, I don't think we are. And I think, you make an interesting point regarding the Brisbane market. the number of properties for sale today in the Brisbane market is about a third of what was for sale in, I believe it was August 2021. So that raises a fairly sort of sizable question. You know, if this is what the Brisbane market looks like when listing volumes are so low in relative terms, what is it going to look like if listing volumes start to normalize?
Yep.
You know, we're not even talking about like, you know, a big rush of full sales, but just normal levels of transactions from just the everyday life that requires the transaction on property.
Yep, absolutely right. Well, I think, you know, there are clearly some significant pressures there in and around there. And it's not uniformly spread. You know, if you go out towards Ipswich or if you go down towards the Gold Coast, you can see some pockets of pain. If you go to the Sunshine Coast, you can see pockets of pain too. So it is, you know, a very fluid situation. But a lot of people who were claiming last year that Brisbane was a dead cert and could only ever go one way, well, it can go the other way too.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. Nothing's ever dead certain, is it?
Spot on.
This is a good chart from Deutsche, and it basically just shows 126 different inflation episodes over the last 52 years. And basically, if you look at the standard sort of range of inflation that where it goes down to over time, it doesn't look too good. It shows just how basically very hopeful the consensus on inflation coming down is, that it's going to be, you know, sort of back in this normal sort of 2 to 3% range in the not too distant future.
It's called hopium. There's a lot of it about, right? And I believe a lot of economists particularly are quite hooked on it.
Well, I mean, I think part of the issue is that I see these charts and these analyses and stuff, and it's, you know, oh well, this episode saw inflation come down. It's like you're talking about 2008. You're talking about, you know, or 2000 or 1990. You're talking about something completely different to the labor market settings, to the economic settings that we face today. And I think that's one of the really, really interesting things. Like, if you go back and you use, say, for example, three major factors. You look at unemployment, you look at core inflation, and you look at the federal funds rate. You look at those three sort of factors, and you go back and you look at, say, like the last, let's call it the last, say, back to 1970. There's only really two instances that are like this, where things are relatively similar, where you've got full employment and where you've got high core inflation. And that's 1970 and 1974. And, well, you know, we all know how the 70s ended.
The difference this time, of course, is the leverage, particularly household leverage. It's a lot higher everywhere, but especially a lot higher in Australia, and that's something else which magnifies the impact of raising rates and the, you know, the problem for many people, because they've just got these huge debts around their neck. So I'm very cautious about making comparisons between the earlier cycles and this cycle, because of that debt leverage problem.
No, I agree. And I think one of the things that is interesting about that is that one of the major differences, and I think we talked about this a few shows ago, one of the major differences between now and the 70s is the 70s saw huge, huge real wages growth in Australia. Massive in some cases, you know, like, you know, this was the period when, you know, you had such large wage increases that you could pay off a home in Sydney or Melbourne in, you know, 4 or 5 years, you know, with, well, it wouldn't go as far as relative ease, but, you know, it was not uncommon.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it's going to be interesting in that respect. But I mean, you make an interesting point about the debt levels, and I think that there is that systemic risk there. But I just wonder, in terms of inflation, if they're going to be able to kill it sufficiently, given, you know, the sort of broader challenges and the changes in consumer psychology that have occurred since the pandemic.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, behavioral finance is a very interesting area, which is some of the things we're touching on here. And it is interesting to watch in my surveys how people are reacting to having less disposable money. What do they choose to give up? Right. And it is quite fascinating when you start looking at it in some granularity as to how households are making these sort of big trade-off decisions. So some people are saying, well, maybe, you know, maybe we should pull kids out of, you know, fee-paying schools and put them into the public schools because that's relatively painless. I know there's a few issues, but, you know, so some people are doing that. Others are saying, well, maybe we should trim our streaming services because we've got five or six and we only need two, you know. So it is interesting just seeing. But a lot of people are wrestling with the question of this debt thing, right? And, you know, as I've mentioned a few times, the refinancing cycle, which is still very hot at the moment, is including equity extraction for quite a few households, right?
I was just about to say that.
Yeah, and that's higher than it's been for a long time. So what that means is that people are actually still using the old property as the magic money machine to square the circle to be able to actually maintain the lifestyle, even if it costs a bit more.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is one of the defining things going for Australia, you know, heading into the future. Because looking at your data, you know, for home equity withdrawals, you know, the proportion of people accessing home equity has risen by 12-fold in the last 18 years.
Yep.
You know, and that is an insane number. Even if you go back to 2020, it's almost 3-fold since the lows at the start of 2020. So it is an absolutely astounding sort of thing, because Australians still have something like $7 trillion worth of equity.
Yep.
So if they want to, and if the banks want to, they can keep tapping that equity till kingdom come, keep inflation high, and completely screw anyone with a home loan.
Absolutely.
So it's possible.
Yeah, it is. And the interesting is the distribution of that equity withdrawal and, you know, who's doing it and what have you, right? And what purposes are they using it for? And, you know, the let's go grab another investment property is pretty much off the agenda now. But, you know, fixing your finances and paying off credit card debt, tick. In some cases, making improvements to your existing property, that's also there too. And then just another very interesting one, just taking that equity and parking it in an offset for emergency purposes. Right? So one of the reasons why the buffers are so big, and you know they are bigger than what they were for some households, is because they've translated equity withdrawal, they've put it into the buffer.
Well, yeah. I mean, if it works for Chinese local government, why not for Aussie households?
Exactly right. And the banks love it, of course, because it just increases their, you know, the amount of credit in the system, which means they're actually making more money on those loans, et cetera, et cetera. And it also means, importantly, that these households aren't in the problem bucket. So, you know, from their perspective, it's a win-win-win-win-win. So it doesn't surprise me that they're actually quite keen to have these refinancing conversations with a little bit of equity extraction as part of the story. And I was chatting to a mortgage broker the other day who's basically two-thirds of his conversations on refinancings include now equity extraction.
Wow. Well, I'd be very curious to see your figures in a couple of months' time, particularly, you know, if we do start to see the economy becoming a little bit more challenging.
Yeah, well, I'll be watching it and, you know, I run these surveys continually, so watch this space.
I certainly will be. Now, there's been a lot said about how inflation is going to play out in the US, so I built this very, very basic little model. What it basically does is it plays out from September this year onwards and basically how things would play out if core inflation was reduced in relative terms by the same amount it was during the financial crisis. So basically this is, you know, crap hitting the fan, so to speak. But some people have said to me, well, what about used cars? That's a huge, huge factor. What if there's a mean reversion in the price of used cars? Well, this is what it looks like. Basically, so over a 12-month period, US core inflation is still going to be about 3.4%. And this is, as I say, based on the GFC, you know, massive meltdown in consumer prices and commodity prices and everything. So I think this sort of gives a bit of an idea of how challenging it will be to kill inflation, even with all the stars aligning all at once for that particular outcome.
Yeah, and what it says to me is a long tail on inflation, right? This is not going to drop down, you know, early next year and suddenly interest rates are going to be low again by the middle of, you know, the 6 months' time, you know, in June next year. This is going to be 2 or 3 years or so. And even then, it's pushing it to get it back into the box.
Exactly, and I think that's really the issue going forward here. I mean, personally, I think something's going to break. We are going to have a major crisis. You know, I think that that's relatively inevitable at this point, whether it's this year or whether it's next year. And I think the question then is, how much does inflation come down? Yeah, sure, it's going to come down because commodity prices are going to get smashed, because that's always what happens. But is it going to be enough to tame these other inflationary pressures overall? Now, I think what might happen is we might see the yo-yo that you and I have discussed, you know, at length previously. You know, that you see this drop in headline inflation because you see this collapse in things like fuel prices, energy prices, etc. But then core inflation still remains quite potent and quite strong. Now, the Fed or the RBA could look at that and go, okay, well, you know, we've had 6 months of inflation getting smashed, we're going to cut rates. But if you do that, and then you throw a bunch of stimulus at the system, and especially with the issues with OPEC, the issues with Russia, the war in Ukraine, etc., a year or so later, you might find yourself in exactly the same position all over again, except this time inflation that was already entrenched now has a buddy called base effect coming from energy prices and all those other things that get hit in a commodity route, and you're right back where you started.
Yeah, I think that's quite plausible, actually. Thinking about,
I don't want it to be.
No. I mean, and it may not be, but it's certainly a plausible scenario. The other thing I'd say in terms of things breaking, very interesting. You know, the ECB lifted 0.75, so they've doubled their deposit rate. You know, literally overnight. But what they've said is that they actually are going to try and deal with this issue of the ultra cheap money that was lent to the banks to lend on, right? In fact, in some cases, negative rates, right? And they're essentially going to try and turn it around, which essentially is draining liquidity, massive amounts of liquidity out of the banking system, right? Now, to me, that is exactly the sort of parallel to what the UK was doing a few weeks ago, right? And you saw what happened then. I have a feeling that Europe and liquidity could actually become the leading point where some of these cracks really start to unwind. And I know that the ECB said that they were thinking about some of these consequences, but I just wonder, to me, liquidity is still the big question.
No, I agree. Europe is going to be an interesting one. I mean, you know, they are in well and truly uncharted territory heading into their winter. And I think one of the interesting things about that is it sort of really flipped some of the sort of traditional European paradigm on its head, you know, because you've got an issue here now where Germany has this enormous trade deficit.
Yes.
Because of the cost of energy and the fact that, you know, exports to China and stuff are dropping precipitously, and Italy has a trade surplus. So there's this really sort of strange, you know, things going on in Europe. And I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe it will be the straw that breaks the camel's back, but the camel's just looking a bit poorly at the moment.
Yeah, it's got a few more lumps than normal, I would say, at the very least.
Okay. This one is job postings from Indeed in the US, and I think that it shows quite nicely the fact that the US labor market is, you know, sort of in overall terms, deteriorating in terms of growth. But I don't think that we've quite reached the point yet where we're going to start to see significant numbers of job losses. Not yet. I think it's coming. I think it's most certainly coming. And I think it's going to hit the US economy hard when it does. But I don't think we're quite there yet.
No, I think that's interesting. And it's, you can see this sort of the slight move down, but there's still more job vacancies, you know, than there used to be, and there are still plenty of options for people. So I was reading something the other day that said even if people find that they've, you know, out of a job, they can get another one. So anybody who wants to work actually can work.
Yeah, I mean, there's 1.7 job openings for every one unemployed person. So, yeah. You know, I think it's still a while away from unemployment starting to rise in a big way in the US. And you know, that goes back to what we were talking about before in terms of the labour market continuing to be an inflationary factor.
Absolutely, and wages growth is still pretty strong over there as well. Again, it's not uniformly spread. There are areas where it's high, areas where it's less high. Mind you, there are two Twitter executives who are now joining the unemployment.
oh, You know, I got to say, I can't pity them because, you know, that level of retirement package would be quite nice, I would imagine. I imagine they would have voted themselves something quite generous
Yeah,
before they left.
and I want to know whether Elon Musk really did turn up with a sink.
I would not put it past. He probably did. You know, I mean, wouldn't surprise me if he just turned up and just threw it out the window, you know, in front of everyone. It's like, that's your job.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Okay. This is the CEO Business Confidence Index for the expectations for the US economy, and they're worse than the financial crisis. They're worse than the dot-com bubble, and they're worse than COVID. So, yeah, I don't really think I need to add anything to that. That pretty much tells the story.
It sort of does tell the story. They're certainly not confident. And in fact, interestingly, several bank analysts have come out recently now and saying the probability of recession next year is a lot higher in the US than it was. So even with everything else that's going on, the slightly more strategic view, not the market view of next week, but the strategic view of next year, is still looking negative. And interestingly, a couple of the big techs, of course, reported in the last couple of days. And the forward indications from a lot of them is that it's going to be really tough. Amazon, for example, is saying it's going to be really tough to sort of maintain momentum. So it all looking a bit sort of flaky, really.
Yeah, and if these sort of, what would you call them, pillars of strength, really, that you know helped hold up the market over the last 2.5 years, you know, people, like you say, you've got, you know, Amazon, Google, Facebook, I'm not calling them Meta. You've these people, you know, these big companies that have been hugely contributive to the strength and to the narrative of the market. You take those away, what are you left with? Not a whole lot. You know, and I think that's going to be really, really key going forward, because if you kick these pillars of strength out from underneath the market, you're going to see these big, big swings in volatility. And well, we're seeing those already.
Yeah, it's partly why the volatility is where it is, and the tech sector is way off because Meta's way down, from I think it was the biggest drop ever or something. It was remarkable. And of course, Meta is struggling with this massive, massive amount of investment in this other nether universe that's out there somewhere. But actually, they're just not getting the revenue from advertising. So maybe they should split the company into two pieces.
Some people have suggested that, you know, I mean, it would probably mean one company that was very profitable and one company that was falling to bits, but you know, why not?
But it just show how we said at the start this was about it's hard to know what's going on. Well, you can see why some of these cross currents, some of the investment banks are doing quite well. Goldman Sachs is saying it's looking all right, but look at Credit Suisse. Their restructuring package came out, disappointed the market. They're going back to the future.
Well, they're a mess, and you know, I mean, as you say, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, contagion in the European banks in the months and year ahead.
Exactly right.
This is from an article from the Wall Street Journal. The link is in my so is in with the charts on Substack, and basically, it shows that while travel volumes, and this is compared with 2019 to sort of remove the pandemic as a factor. While travel volumes for economy class passengers are down 21%, business class passengers are up 28%. So, this I think is just one of those little pieces that's indicative of the fact that the wealthy are still doing very, very well and they're still very keen on spending, even though you have seen markets take a dive. You know, so I think that there has been a, you know, I don't know if it's permanent, but there has been a long-term shift in the psychology of more wealthy households towards spending more in the now.
Yeah, well, I agree with that again in my surveys. I keep talking about the one third, one third, one third, right? So one third of people are actually feeling pretty affluent. They've got huge amounts of buffers and they're happy to go on spending. And they tend to be the more affluent. They tend to be the ones in particular areas of our major cities in particular. Obviously, full employment isn't the problem there. And then you've got the one third down the bottom that are scraping along the bottom and just trying to wrestle with every dollar that has to come in and go out, and you've got one third in the middle that's dragging, kicking and screaming towards the bottom. But that one third is more than where three quarters of wealth actually sits.
Yep, I think that pretty much sums it up.
Absolutely right.
I think there's been a lot of talk about this idea of a capitulation in markets, that, you know, that everyone's panicking and everyone's, you know, there's the fear index is at its, you know, sort of absolute peak and blah, 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 blah. But we haven't seen the outflows from US equity ETFs that you would expect. And that's true in a bunch of different things across the board. I mean, for example, the other day when the market really started to roar on the idea of a Fed not pivot, you saw people piling into call options for things like GameStop and Bed Bath & Beyond and all these other sort of meme stocks. So I think that we're still quite a ways away from that normal, shall we say, capitulation moment that defines the end of a bear market.
Well, there's two observations there. The first is that, you know, you can see from the chart that the, you know, the flows are in. Remember, a lot of retail investors, relatively new investors, got a lot of money over the last 2 or 3 years, you know, and a lot of that went into the markets. Now, some of those are still playing around with that, right? The other interesting observation is the volatility index is knocking around 30. Now, if you look trend-wise, 30 is not high enough to really create capitulation. All right, it needs to go quite a lot higher, I think probably 36 to 38, and stay there a bit, which means that the volatility index is still not actually saying we're at, you know, at fear point yet. And all of those things together, and all, of course, the all of the market conversations that are going on, and all those analysts who are saying, you know, no, the markets are fine, you know, it's all about trying to keep this little momentum going and trying to keep people in the markets. The other side of it, though, is, if you do actually decide to come out of the markets, where else do you put your money?
Well,
interesting question.
To be honest, if I was an American, inflation-adjusted bonds, 9.62%, mate. There was so much appeal for these inflation-adjusted bonds that the website crashed. And I've got to be honest, if Australia had inflation-adjusted bonds that were buying, that were selling at 9.62%, I tell you what, I'd be buying them with both hands.
Absolutely right. Well, the bond, you know, the bonds actually are very interesting at the moment with where they are and where they might go. So there is definitely a sort of a little switcheroo going on. Of course, a lot of people called it very early and piled into bonds, and then the bond price went the wrong way, right? So it's not necessarily perfect, but those are amazing returns, aren't they?
Oh, they certainly are. And I mean, yeah, you know, they used to be, well, not when I say used to be, I mean literally 6 months ago, you know, the acronym TINA. Yeah. There is no alternative. It's, well, TINA's back and TINA's had a makeover, and this time there is an alternative.
That's right, TINA too.
Yeah. Now this I just love, because basically there's this idea out there that the Fed pivots, everything goes great, etc. Well, technically speaking, the Fed pivot is actually, in the short term, is not good for stocks in historical terms, with the exception, naturally, of 2020, when they threw the absolute kitchen sink at everything, and in fiscal, monetary, you name it.
Yeah, and that's a very important observation, isn't it? That it takes time, right? So don't think that if the Fed does pivot, if it ever pivots, right, and it probably will at some point, but that doesn't mean tomorrow afternoon the market suddenly go, whoopee, we'll go off. No, that's not what happens, right? It takes time. And that's because, of course, the markets are reflecting the earnings potential of corporations. And just as now, we're only starting to see, frankly, the first signs of earnings pressure work into the stock prices. It'll take a bit of time for that to actually go the other way, if in fact things, you know, do go better. So, as an important lesson in lag here.
Yeah, and I think that is key across pretty much most of the things that we've been talking about today. Yeah. That there is that lag, and there is that, you know, sort of rearview mirror effect, so to speak.
Absolutely right.
Okay. Now, this is on the Chinese labor market. And basically, it just goes, you know, despite all of the sort of, you know, hopeful narratives that are out there on China, things are really, really not looking that good for the Chinese labor market, particularly for blue collar workers. And if this keeps up, I think it could be quite a sizable problem and something that's going to need to be targeted quite closely for some form of solution by, you know, President for Life.
Yeah, well, the you know, now emperor, pretty much. I mean, you know, he could well be. It's a very interesting situation, right? Because basically, it doesn't look as though there's going to be any major change in the short term to policy. So we'll still have the COVID lockdowns. We're still going to crunch down on property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there are some very interesting consequences. Consumption, household consumption in China is going through the floor.
Yep.
And that, of course, a couple of years ago was effectively where they were going to look for the next phase of growth. And with the demographic shift, we were seeing effectively, you know, population growth very, very low now. They can go on building property, but they've got nobody to put in them.
Well, I mean, and just on the topic of consumption, I mean, it's all well and good for people to say, well, oh, you know, at any given time, 85 or 90% of China is out of lockdown. But as anyone who's been in lockdown will tell you, particularly those people in countries like China, where the support isn't raining money from the sky like it did in Australia, if you're having a situation where your business is randomly just being closed down for a month or 6 weeks at a time, or you're not able to go to work and get paid, you're not going to go out and go buy a new big television, or you're not going to go out and buy, you know, a new car. You're going to be very, very frugal. You're going to, you know, build a war chest to insulate yourself and pay your bills and, you know, service your debts. But I don't know. I mean, I talk with, you know, China analysts, and they don't understand where all the bullishness is coming from. But then you know, you sort of see the amount of money that Wall Street makes off China, and then you go, oh, that's why.
Absolutely right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens to the US bonds that are owned by Chinese companies and entities.
It is going to be
That's
interesting.
For me, a very important thing to watch.
Well, especially with the bond differential being as large as it is, you know, you're talking about like the largest differential in like 15, you know, basically for the last 15 yep. years, you know, a US bond pays for, I mean, the interesting thing is a US bond, so like a 2-year bond, pays well over 1% more than the equivalent Chinese bond. And you just go, well, why would you buy a Chinese bond? You know, you're literally talking about the global reserve asset versus something that she could turn around and go, nah. And, you know, and I think that the Chinese currency story is yet to play out on that count as well. I mean, you have that yield differential in place and nothing breaks. There's going to be continued downward pressure on the value of the Chinese yuan.
Yep.
And hey presto, that's going to hit Australia.
Yep. And I think you can draw some parallels with what's going on with Japan, right? Because effectively Japan is now, well, their negative interest rate's knocking on zero, right? And looking as though it could be even go a little higher. Now, I know that the current architect of the low rate policy doesn't leave until next year. But at some point, it wouldn't surprise me to see Japan trying to actually sort of move into a different mode, and that would have interesting consequences because, of course, their currency is also getting murdered too.
Well, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? Is there a point where eventually, you know, does the yen go to 250 yen to a dollar, or does it, you know, does it go to 200 yen to a dollar? You know, all these numbers that people are talking about that haven't been seen since the 80s, you know, are on the table. So I just wonder, you know, are they going to keep selling bonds? You know, like as you say, or you know, and that's going to push US yields up, which pushes the dollar up, which pushes the yen down, and then you've got, you know, your lovely perpetual motion machine that basically just runs on misery.
That's exactly right, and that's why, you know, there are so many of these variables that are actually driving a lot of different behaviors and different outcomes. I would say to anybody, you've got to understand the bond markets and how the bond markets are behaving at the moment, because they are by far the most critical element, the international element, that's actually driving a lot of the behavior that we're seeing around the place at the moment. And unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that's being written about it is not actually getting to the heart of the matter. So I'm going to be interested to look for opportunities Operation Twist, where basically you do one thing at the short end and one thing at the longer end. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, because that's a way of creating more liquidity without necessarily creating more quantitative easing directly, but you actually are, but it's just different. I wouldn't be surprised to see that. I think we're going to see some significant dynamics in terms of the currencies and, you know, the impact on the bond markets. And as we saw in the UK, you know, if the bond markets get it into their head that they don't like the policy, they'll just change the Prime Minister.
Yeah, well, exactly. And not only that, but if you look at bonds recently over the last, say, week or so, they have been absolutely all over the show. You saw the US 10-year up to above 4.3% briefly.
Yep. Now it's down below 4. Yeah.
Yeah, now back down below 4. I mean, it's gone as low as, like, you know, 3.9 something. And, I mean, okay, you know, you look at that and you go, oh, that's not like that big of a deal. But for the bond market, those moves are gargantuan. And, you know, I mean, I think that leads back to the title of this show. I don't really think anyone really knows exactly what's going on.
No, well, I was talking to a bond trader who's been in the market a long, long time, and he said bonds were boring. That was the whole point about this whole part of the market. Bonds were, you know, safe, secure, boring, the anchor around which everything else orbited. Well, we've lost the anchor.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We actually don't know now which direction it's going in, how far it's going, how quickly it's going, which creates a huge amount of additional uncertainty, not only in the bond market itself, but more broadly into the financial system. And that financial system touches corporates, it touches governments and mortgage rates, all those things. So that's why this degree of uncertainty is, you know, unheard of. It's because the bond market's got unanchored. And at the moment, I'm not sure how that anchor gets locked back in again.
The best theory I've got in the short term is that something big enough breaks that in not only in the financial system, but in the real economy, that has some serious knock-on effects, like a Lehman, like a housing crash, something that's going to be large enough to prompt bonds to basically, for yields to drop back towards where they were before the pandemic, or even where they were during the pandemic, if the wheels really fall off. Because beyond that, I don't really see, you know, a way for them to get back to the way they were. Because, you know, at the end of the day, the Fed needs to be credible in the fight against inflation. And, you know, I think that's a key part for the bond market more broadly.
Correct. Fed needs to be credible in terms of inflation domestically, but also they are fixated on a strong US dollar as the reserve currency into the future.
Yeah.
Got to put those two factors. Yeah.
No, I agree. And I think that's the thing. You know, everyone's going, oh, but the Fed, the USD is a wrecking ball. Yeah, it is. They want it to be, because it's insulating US consumers against inflation. Like, I believe it was Simon Rhee, a finance author who made a really good point on Twitter recently. He said the US dollar has appreciated something like 20%, you know, 15 or 20% over the last 12 months. What would inflation look like in the US if it didn't?
Correct.
The dollar falls, inflation goes up, and then you're back where you started. So, you know, things aren't so simple as the Fed pivots and then everything's great.
No, I'm afraid that the degree of uncertainty is going to continue. Tarek, as always, very important conversation. Appreciate all your work on the slides. And, well, I suppose in a couple of weeks' time, when we circle around to do some more, it'll be the same old, same old, only different, won't it?
Well, as always, there'll be plenty more to talk about.
See you soon. Take care.
You too, mate. Bye.